It's Thursday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Welcome and hello. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, disagreement surfaces in addressing North Korea's nuclear test.
The government in China is just trying to divert the attention to other allegations that have no reasonable ground.
Human rights workers facing tougher challenges in China. Also ahead, opportunity abounds on Mars and relationships explored in a new movie. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held several hours of talks with his Chinese counterpart, Foreign Minister Wang Yi, with both diplomats saying they support a new U.N. Security Council resolution on North Korea's nuclear program. But Mr. Kerry called for significant new measures to punish Pyongyang for its fourth nuclear blast on January 6th. Mr. Wang cautioned a new resolution must not provoke new tensions or destabilize the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Wang, pressed to do more to pressure its ally to give up its nuclear program, insists Beijing's position opposing it and seeking a diplomatic resolution has been clear-cut and reasonable. The editor of the Asia-Pacific current events publication The Diplomat, Ankit Panda, told VOA's Victor Beatty that he does not expect that the talks will provide a high degree of success.
Overall, there is simply no common understanding between the United States and China on the right way to approach the North Korean issue, and nothing really changed with the nuclear test in that regard. The United States continues to insist that North Korea has to make some sort of bona fide gesture of denuclearization before it will consider returning to negotiations, and China continues to push for restraint and a return to the six-party talks process, which has been dead for about half a decade now. So it's really not a positive prognosis at this point.
Well, North Korea walked out of those talks, as I recall.
Absolutely, they did. Those fell apart, and they haven't come back together since. And Kim Jong-un obviously took over in 2011, and we've seen two nuclear tests under him with no sign of the North Korean nuclear program slowing down.
When news media write headlines like Kerry to urge China to put more pressure on North Korea, what does it mean? What could China do that it's not doing now?
Stopping oil exports, stopping civilian flights flying over its territory. But in general, the United States would be interested in seeing China apply strong UN sanctions against North Korea, which it is not willing to do, because Beijing holds the position that this problem is something that needs to be solved through diplomacy, through restraint, and it doesn't believe that punishing North Korea is the right path. And, you know, there is a degree of self-interest there for China. Refugees regularly cross the border into China from North Korea with great difficulty. And China worries that if the hammer of sanctions comes down even further, internal instability in North Korea could destabilize its border with the country. And that's obviously very negative for Beijing. So Beijing is happy to maintain a modicum of stability. Obviously, it's not happy with the nuclear test at all. China definitely does not support North Korea's continued nuclear developments, but it's also not keen to see economic difficulties in North Korea destabilize the country, potentially leading to a collapse of the regime or a potential refugee influx into China.
So if there's no progress made in forging some sort of common front between China and the United States vis-a-vis North Korea, where does the answer to responding to North Korea's latest nuclear test come from? Would it be the UN?
No, and that's actually the question that many policymakers and experts are wrangling with right now. There's really no consensus. And my sense, you know, talking to experts after North Korea's nuclear test, including experts with 20, 25 years of experience dealing with North Korea and the United States, is that essentially, we're at an impasse. There is the uncomfortable prospect that some people propose of acknowledging North Korea as a nuclear state and using that as the starting step to negotiations with North Korea, and essentially acknowledging that the policy conversation needs to shift from preventing North Korea from becoming a nuclear state to containing it as a nuclear state. And obviously, as you can imagine, that's politically very uncomfortable.
The state-run Xinhua news agency in a commentary said it was unrealistic to rely merely on China to press North Korea to abandon its nuclear program. We're taking a look now at social media with Michael Lippin, who joins us in the studio to talk about a rather solemn topic that was trending Wednesday. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Jim. That's right. Well, you often see things like pop star birthdays and tributes dominating Twitter's list of worldwide trending topics. But today, one item that stood out was Auschwitz. It's the former Nazi German death camp in Poland where many victims of the Holocaust were murdered. Wednesday, January 27th, is the 71st anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau camp by Soviet troops toward the end of World War II. The United Nations General Assembly designates each January 27th as an International Holocaust Remembrance Day. The UN uses the occasion to honor those murdered by Nazi Germany, namely 6 million Jews and several million other people who also were targets of Nazi persecution, such as minority Roma. Besides hashtag Auschwitz, another Twitter hashtag that many people use today was hashtag Holocaust Remembrance. Well, here in Washington, Remembrance Day was marked with a ceremony at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, not far from VOA. One of the speakers there was German ambassador to the United States, Peter Wittig, and this is what he had to say.
We're living at a time where Europe, and at its center Germany, is experiencing a refugee crisis of unprecedented proportions. In these times of change, where our Jewish citizens increasingly fear renewed anti-Semitism, our message is simple and resolute. Anti-Semitism has no place in Germany. Anyone who comes to our country, who wants to live amongst us, must know that we will not abide any racism, intolerance, or anti-Semitism.
Well, you can find German Ambassador Wittig on Twitter. His handle is @AMBWITTIG. He's also encouraging people to say how they are remembering the Holocaust by using the hashtag #IRememberBy and then saying what action you're taking. Jim?
Michael, thanks so much for that. Michael Lippin is on Twitter himself. You can follow him @Michael_Lippin and also at our International Edition page. That's @VOA_IE. I'm out there as well, @VOA Stevenson. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Swedish human rights activist Peter Dahlin has returned to his home country after he was deported from China and accused of endangering state security. The 35-year-old Dahlin is the co-founder of Chinese Urgent Action Group, which assists Chinese human rights lawyers with training and other support. He was detained earlier this month and last week was seen on Chinese state television confessing to the allegations. Patrick Poon is China researcher for Amnesty International based in Hong Kong. He tells International Edition's Sarah Williams what this means for other human rights workers and members of non-governmental organizations in mainland China.
You can see how it is so alarming for other international human rights workers who are now doing advocacy work, in particular in mainland China, because what we could see Peter's organization in helping would be just like helping human rights activists, human rights lawyers to go through, you know, the legal procedures to help the petitioners or those underprivileged to go through the legal framework within mainland China. So it's really legal for them to help those people. But then like the way it is now presented as the way that Chinese government try to present them through the CCTV program, making Peter and, you know, some others also recently to confess in the official national broadcaster, can only see how the government in China is just trying to divert the attention to other allegations that has no reasonable grounds. but try to divert the attention on, you know, trying to make them confess instead of giving them any access to immediate access to lawyers. And in Peter's case, he actually was only given access to consular service because of the visits at the very end of his detention. So, I mean, like, all this actually would have very chilling effects on the national human rights community working in China and also the mainland Chinese civil society as well. Because the government now is having a very hard line on cracking down on civil society in China, including human rights lawyers and these human rights activists and human rights workers in general.
And in this situation, in Peter Dahlin's situation, he was detained along with his girlfriend, Pan Jinling, who is a Chinese citizen. Is it known her status?
I mean, like what you learned also in seeing public statements made by Peter and also Peter's colleagues is that Peter's girlfriend has been released, but she remains in China. So it's very worrying whether, you know, now she may not be allowed to go anywhere. This is very unclear about whether she could leave the country or not. And also now she also can't speak much. As we understand, it's difficult for Peter to talk about the case as well, because it's really the case that now they can not talk about the case. Otherwise, there may be some kind of revenge. I'm concerned whether would be put on Peter's girlfriend if they talk too much, because the situation seems to be like that. But as far as we understand, she's now released but remains in China.
And that seems to be the pattern with a number of these people who've been arrested or detained, that authorities, they have a relative or close friend, and so they're no doubt concerned about their loved ones.
I mean, like these tactics, we can see is justified for us to suspect whether, you know, the government in China is using this as a way to silence critics.
Patrick Poon, China researcher for Amnesty International, speaking from Hong Kong about the deportation of Swedish activist Peter Dahlin from China. This week, the rover Opportunity reached its 12th anniversary exploring the surface of Mars. John Callis is the project manager at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, and joins us to tell us more about this amazing and ongoing mission.
Opportunity and Spirit landed in January of 2004, and each rover was designed for a 90-day mission on the surface of Mars, 90 Martian days. When we got to the end of those 90 days, the rovers were still doing well. You know, we had determined, based on what we knew from the Pathfinder mission, how long a solar-powered vehicle could last on the surface, mainly due to dust accumulation on the solar panels, and we figured, well, Sojourner was designed to last a week. We're proposing this mission to last 90 days. That's more than a factor of 10 improvement. And we thought that was quite good. But the reality is the dusty conditions on Mars are not as bad as we thought they would be. And also, the wind comes along and starts to blow the dust off. And that was something we didn't expect. It's something we can't predict, but happens pretty regularly. And that has really allowed both rovers to go well beyond the 90 days. Spirit lasted 6 years, and Opportunity is still going today, some 12 years later.
I'm sure along the way you have learned little tricks to keep that thing going, ways to position it to recharge itself and to keep it clean.
Yes, we certainly take advantage of the terrain to improve energy production. So in the wintertime, we like to be on north-facing slopes. We're in the southern hemisphere, so in the winter, the sun is going to be low on the horizon in the north. So if we're on north-facing slopes, we get an improvement in energy production, you know, much like when you take your lounge chair and you adjust it to improve your suntan if you're outside. And so that's just one of the techniques that we've been using that helps us out and has allowed us to keep going.
Originally, in that first 90-day period, what was the rover looking for?
Well, we went to Mars to do classic field geology. The rovers were designed to be robotic field geologists. So they have mobility, just like a geologist can walk and hike around. They have a vision system, just like the geologist uses their own eyes to identify objects, to then go up and get close to, get down on your hands and knees. And we have a robotic arm that has some devices on the end of it, one of which is a little rock grinder, which is the analog of the geologist's rock hammer. And so we've been exploring Mars the way a field geologist would explore Mars. And so we're trying to answer many questions about the planet. One is, you know, what was the role of water in the ancient past on Mars? You know, when was that, and what happened to all that water?
I don't know that anybody expected it to go 12 years, and it looks like it's going to go at least much longer than that, the rate things are going. What were some of the surprises that the rover has uncovered in that time?
Well, you know, the great thing about a roving mission is that because it moves, every day is like a brand new mission because you've been able to visit different geology and see new things. And so in the 12 years on Mars, the rover has driven more than a marathon, more than 26.2 miles. Over that distance, we've actually been able to go back in time on Mars because we've been able to drive to places where the geology is even older than where we landed. So we're in a place now which dates back to the Nowakian era on Mars, which is the earliest epoch when Mars was wet and warm and had a thicker atmosphere. It gives us the chance to visit that time era and to try to understand what was going on the planet, what were the conditions like. And what both rovers have established for us is that Mars was indeed a habitable world at one time. And you start to discover that Mars was a world very much like the Earth some 3.5 to 4 billion years ago. And that's when life started on the Earth. So you have at least two planets in our solar system that had similar conditions, and life started on one. So the next question for Mars is, was there life or is there life on the planet?
Congratulations on 12 great years. We look forward to much more.
My pleasure, and thank you very much.
John Callis, project manager at the Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
A new film from Korean-American director So-young Kim, called Love Song, explores the complexities of muted desire between two longtime friends. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the film, which is now showing at the Sundance Film Festival in Utah, features actors Riley Keough and Jenna Malone.
Sarah, played by Riley Keough, and Mindy, played by Jenna Malone, are longtime friends. Sarah is married to a man who is never home, and they have a daughter. Mindy is a free spirit who seems to know exactly how to coax Sarah out of safety. When Mindy visits Sarah one day, she persuades her friend to take off on a road trip. One gets the sense that there's more than just friendship here, but the feelings between the two women remain subtly subterranean. The film jolts the audience with an abrupt end to the road trip, and then we see the two characters 3 years later when Sarah is attending Mindy's wedding. It is there that Sarah finally confronts her feelings about her friend. If the relationship is not made completely clear, are they friends, are they lovers, are they friends who might want to be lovers, that's on purpose. Director So-young Kim, known for her Korean language films In Between Days and Treeless Mountain, says she wanted to explore the evolving dynamics between the two characters.
I love love stories, and I wanted to explore an area that's kind of unusual, you know, and I wanted to tell dynamics between two friends who are women, and they're not necessarily, you know, one sexual preference or the other, but I just wanted them to explore what their relationship could mean, you know, and then fall in love, fall out of love, and try to navigate that.
Riley Keough, best known for being Elvis Presley's granddaughter, as well as her film work in The Runaways, Magic Mike, and Mad Max Fury Road, says that she enjoys working with Kim, particularly on character-driven stories like Love Song.
No, I worked with her on a short film we did called Spark and Light, and I worked with her husband on this movie, Jack and Diane, and so we've done, and this is the third thing I've done with them, and we're kind of really close, and they like to do things, you know, with people they've worked with before and very intimately and shoot out of their house, and, you know, I stayed in their garage, and that's kind of how I like doing things, and they do too, so it's fun, you know, when you find people that you like working with, you kind of, I think, just keep working with them.
The film is entered in the drama category at the Sundance Film Festival. It comes at a time when Hollywood is facing criticism for a lack of diversity in the Oscar nominees. Jenna Malone says the film industry is reflecting a societal problem, and only when society changes will filmmaking change.
You know, if anything's lacking in the film industry, it's because we're lacking it in society, you know. So it's more like we all have to come together and change before, you know, we can't just kind of put filmmakers up in a some golden box somewhere. You know, they exist because we put them there. You know, we need to tell different kind of stories. We need to evolve as a society, you know, and I think that's more important than being like, oh, we have to embrace all things female. It's like, no, we have to embrace all things human. And once we do that, it's not going to matter whether it's man or woman or black or white, you know.
Love Song also stars Rosanna Arquette as Mindy's estranged mother. Brooklyn Decker stars as a selfish maid of honor, while Ryan Eggold is Mindy's fiancé, Life. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we invite you to follow our Twitter stream, at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter and engineer Keith Holmes. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope to have you back again real soon. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986, but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.